It's the Burt Cohen Show. Special show today. In the first half hour, we have Professor Noam Chomsky, and the second half hour, we have Senator George McGovern. Professor Chomsky, thank you very much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show today.
Glad to be with you.
If you're not familiar with the name Noam Chomsky, well, you probably are. He's a professor emeritus in the Department of Linguistics and Philosophy at MIT, where he's worked for over 50 years. Chomsky has been described as the father of modern linguistics. He's credited as the creator or co-creator of the Chomsky hierarchy, the universal grammar theory. Chomsky is known for his critiques of U.S. foreign policy and contemporary capitalism. And according to the Arts and Humanities Citation Index, Noam Chomsky is the most frequently cited, one of the most frequently cited persons alive, one of the eight most frequently cited authors of all time. Well, again, thanks for being with us, Professor Chomsky. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu can certainly bluster, clearly for internal political consumption. But, Professor Chomsky, you don't really believe Israel would be foolish enough to attack Iran, do you?
I doubt that they would do it on their own. But what they may be planning to do, I, of course, have no direct evidence, but what I suspect they may be planning to do is to create a situation in which the U.S. will bomb Iran.
Yikes.
That's what they would like, of course. And that might mean staging incidents in the Gulf, carrying out an act which would lead to Iranian retaliation that would then bring the U.S. in, or many other possible scenarios. That doesn't seem to me, I don't say it's likely, but it seems to me the kind of thing that I would expect they'd be thinking about, maybe planning.
I have a hard time believing that Obama would fall for that, but maybe he would. I mean,
suppose, you know, let's imagine something. The U.S. has a huge naval presence in the Gulf. Suppose there's an attack on a U.S. ship, which
could happen.
The U.S. would react to that, and that might escalate off into a major conflict.
Hmm.
And an attack like that could be staged.
Oh, I'm sure it could, because Iran has those small boats that are constantly harassing the force out there.
And they have the batteries on the shores.
I wonder who is going to influence policy here in America. And I wonder about the power of AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. They've had tremendous power in Washington and our own Congress. I wonder, it seems that AIPAC and the Israeli lobby would love to have the U.S. back them up and attack Iran. I get the sense that the power of AIPAC in Congress is starting to diminish. Do you see that? Maybe I'm being too optimistic.
Well, for one thing, I've never really been all that convinced of the power of AIPAC, frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, as long as AIPAC is acting in consonance with the interests and concerns of major centers of U.S. power, then it's influential. But if it conflicts with those, its influence disappears. I mean, if, for example, AIPAC were acting in ways that were harmful to the perceived interests of military industry or the corporate sector, major sectors of the corporate sector, or major state interests, it would simply disappear. And in fact, that's happened over and over. It's usually not remembered, but I think Obama is probably the first president not to have faced down AIPAC when there was an issue that the U.S. regarded seriously. So the Bush administration, for example, which was very, you know, supportive of Israel, and nevertheless, when Israel wanted to do something that the U.S. didn't like, they just ordered them not to, and in fact, forced them not to do it. One striking case was in 2005, I think it was, when Israel wanted to provide advanced military technology to China. Israel's has a highly militarized economy, and one of its primary sources of income is military exports, high-tech military exports. And China's, of course, a huge potential market, so they want to get in there. But the U.S. doesn't want them to do it. And when they tried to do it anyway over U.S. objections in 2005, the Bush administration simply ordered them not to and went out of its way to humiliate them. It insisted that Israel release a public apology. It refused to allow to meet with high Israeli military officials who were coming here. And, of course, they backed down and AIPAC was quiet. Things like that have happened repeatedly. Obama is perhaps the first president who has not decided to do that. That's a separate question. But I don't think that their power is that overwhelming. In fact, if you take a look at the more extreme support for Israeli policies, you get a sense of where the support's coming from. So in the media, for example, the major, the most extreme support for Israeli policy in the media is coming from the Wall Street Journal editorial pages. You know, Wall Street Journal isn't intimidated by AIPAC. They don't care about it one way or another. It's the Journal of the Business Community. Take a look at the two political parties. It's the Republicans who are more extreme. Democrats are pretty extreme, but the Republicans much more so. Well, you know, the Republicans don't get the Jewish vote. They don't get Jewish money. They're not under any particular AIPAC influence, but they're the more extreme, and the sources are different. One is that they are the more extreme pro-business party, and the business world is quite supportive of Israeli policies. The other is just their base. Increasingly, their base is they've chosen to design policies that lead to a base which is substantially evangelical Christians. Mm. Well, you know, they're not controlled by AIPAC.
No.
But they happen to be extremely pro-Israel.
Yes.
For all sorts of reasons having to do with their theology and so on.
Right.
And there are other factors like that that shouldn't be overlooked.
Well, I wonder if it's interesting how a lot of the Republicans are claiming, and I suppose it's the evangelicals are claiming that Obama is tilting too much toward the Palestinians. I get the sense that you see it rather differently, that Obama is, you know, kowtowing and is standing up even less. I mean, I remember Ronald Reagan had more of a, it seems, a balanced approach to Israel and Palestine.
Yeah. Well, I think every president pre-Obama has had a more balanced approach.
Hmm.
And I think this was pretty obvious even before the primaries. Actually, I wrote about it before the primaries. I published things about it, just taking a look at his record in the Senate and his webpage. It was practically genuflecting to Israel.
And that, I don't imagine that... well, I don't see it changing particularly as the election comes on. Now, you know, there's all this talk about nuclear weapons in Iran, and I don't think anybody wants to see Iran with nuclear weapons. We don't want to see them joining the nuclear club with Israel, Pakistan, and India. Do you think, what's your sense? Are they developing nuclear weapons, and what might be an effective policy so that they would have no interest in developing nuclear weapons, and it would be transparent?
Well, on whether they're developing nuclear weapons or not, I have no information beyond what's produced by the U.S. intelligence system. And their judgment is
they're not.
They have not made a decision to develop nuclear weapons, so I don't know any more than that. I used to say exactly what you just said. Nobody wants them to have nuclear weapons. That's what I wrote a couple of years ago, repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
But I've learned otherwise. There have been, in the last 2 or 3 years, extensive polls in the Arab world of Arab public opinion. And a little to my surprise, it turns out that a majority of people in the Arab world think the region would be more secure if Iran had nuclear weapons. That's because very few regard Iran as a threat, I think 5% in the latest poll.
Mm.
The threat they perceive is the United States and Israel. And in fact, opposition to U.S. Israeli policies is so strong that a majority even thinks it would be preferable for Iran to have nuclear weapons. Now, I don't want them to have nuclear weapons any more than you do, and I don't think we should. And there are ways to reduce that likelihood. The obvious way is to move towards a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East,
a zone
in which nobody will have nuclear weapons. Now, there's overwhelming support for that in the world, and support for it in the region, too, overwhelming. In fact, support is so strong that the Obama administration has been compelled to say, well, yes, we kind of agree in principle, but the U.S. has blocked any move in that direction in practice. It insists that any such move must be delayed until there's a comprehensive peace treaty, which I don't have to comment on that.
Right.
And it also insists that any move must exclude Israel. Well, okay, that kills it.
That certainly does.
But, yeah.
We're talking with Professor Noam Chomsky, a very well-known author who's written quite a bit about the Middle East, and of course a great linguistics professor at MIT as well. What about the Arab Spring of last year? I wonder if the hopes are dashed completely. What is the actual American role, and what do you think it should be with regard to the Arab Spring and the situation in Syria now?
Well, those are separate questions.
Yes.
With regard to the Arab Spring, the U.S. position is fear, and the U.S. will make, and its allies will make any effort they can to prevent significant democratization in the Arab world. And the reason is quite obvious. Take the polling results that I just mentioned, which have been consistent all the way through. So, say, right at the outbreak of the Arab Spring in Egypt, the most important Arab country, polls released by the Brookings Institute in the United States, you know, major institute, found that I think maybe 90% of the population regarded Israel and the U.S. as the main threats they faced. About 10% maybe or so regarded Iran as a threat, and maybe 70% thought that the region would be better off if Iran had nuclear weapons. Well, democratization means that policies like that will, beliefs like that will, attitudes like that will turn into policy. And surely the West doesn't want that. So therefore they have to be opposed to democratization, and they are. In the countries of major interest to the West, the oil-producing countries, the dictatorships of the Arabian Peninsula, there has been no Arab Spring. Any attempt at even mild protest has been crushed very quickly with U.S. support.
Yeah.
The major places where there, in fact, about the only places where there have been some significant successes are Tunisia and Egypt, where at least the Western-backed dictators were overthrown. France, which is the most influential Western country in Tunisia, tried to protect the dictator till the last possible moment, and the U.S. did the same in Egypt. But they were overthrown. There's significant steps towards greater freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of labor organizing. The labor movements were central to these developments, and that's all significant. On the other hand, when the political system is opened up, than the only organized political forces, right, of course, come to the fore, and those are the Islamist forces.
Right, the Muslim Brotherhood.
And Ennahda in Tunisia and the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt.
And there are powers in the U.S. that don't want that to happen. Well, Syria, should the U.S., Britain, and France supply arms to the Free Syrian Army, or is there a similar fear of the people there deciding for themselves? How do you see that situation in Syria?
Well, actually, nobody is really supplying much in the way of arms to the Free Syrian Army.
For sure.
The U.S. is now talking about providing
money,
communication equipment, and non-lethal assistance. I think everyone on the outside who's at least thinking about it, Turkey, France, Britain, the United States, and even the NGOs like the International Crisis Group and others, what they're all concerned about is that if it turns into a major civil war, it's already a civil war,
right,
but if it turns into a major militarized civil war, the results inside Syria could just be devastating. I mean, and it's not at all clear what would come out of it. So they, from the Western point of view, the outcome of the overthrow of Assad might be, from their point of view, worse than Assad.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're all holding back Israel as well for the same reasons. In fact, my strong suspicion is that the U.S. and Britain were quite pleased, France also, quite pleased that Russia and China vetoed the Security Council resolution. If the Western powers wanted to intervene, they wouldn't care what the Security Council says. They never do. But this gives them a kind of a pretext not to have to do anything. They can say, well, what can we do? The Russians and the Chinese blocked it. I don't see any indication that they want to do anything much.
Interesting. Well,
it's hard to think of an outcome in Syria that isn't pretty terrible, but the maybe least terrible possible outcome is what Kofi Annan is trying to do right now. Whether it'll work, we don't know, but if his intervention could succeed in leading to a ceasefire and moves towards some kind of negotiations among the conflicting parties, I don't think a very pretty outcome would emerge, but better than any other that I can think of.
Again, we're talking with Professor Noam Chomsky, largely about the Middle East, a subject upon which he's written a tremendous amount. I want to switch a little bit. I'm not sure when it was, but you wrote something about manufactured consent, that the media in the United States, that the consent of the governed has been specifically manufactured. Now we have the Internet. We're well into the 21st century. Professor Chomsky, do you think the Internet has, in fact, helped level the playing field between the powerful and the powerless? Is it now any more difficult to manufacture consent?
I mean, the Internet is a very significant development, and I use it all the time. I'm sure you do.
Of course.
And there are all kinds of things you can do with it that were much harder to do before. On the other hand, in this regard, it's not so clear what the effect is. I don't think there's no detectable effect that I can see on the way in which the media represent and portray domestic international affairs. So just to take the few examples we've talked about, the availability of the Internet means that you and I, if we know what we're looking for, can discover the polls of Arab public opinion, but the media don't cover it. And that means virtually no one in the country knows about it.
Uh-huh.
And that's very crucial information. You want to understand U.S. policy there. You want to understand what's happening. Not knowing about Arab public opinion is an enormous gap. So sure, it's there on the Internet. buried.
Yeah.
Having the internet available is kind of like having the Library of Congress available if you want to become a historian of England or a biologist. Everything is there, but you don't know what to look for. And so it's what's important and significant gets swamped by fabrication, propaganda, irrelevancies, cults, all sorts of things.
Yeah.
You just have to understand how to use it, and that requires a level of education, organization, interaction, which is very much missing.
Well, one thing that, you know, the power of the corporate media, there's overwhelming opposition now to continued American presence in the Afghanistan war. But even though there is tremendous opposition to it, what is it about the people believing they don't have the power to do something about it? How is it that people have given up and that there are not people out in the streets saying, bring our troops home?
Well, the extent to which people have given up is pretty remarkable, and it tells us a lot about the state of democracy. So, yes, there's majority opposition to the Afghanistan war, but take a look at the public attitudes towards, say, Congress. I mean, you know, approval of Congress is in single digits.
Yes.
But a majority of the population on some polls thinks that they all ought to be thrown out. Anybody doing anything about it? Or take, say, domestic policy. A majority of the population, a considerable majority, thinks that the major domestic problem is joblessness, not the deficit. The government, the banks, the media say the problem is the deficit. So you have a focus on the deficit and not on joblessness. There was a deficit commission, no jobs commission. With regard to the deficit, which for the public is a minor problem, and I think they're right.
Yes.
The public has views on how to deal with the deficit. Their view is increase taxation on the very rich and on the corporations,
mm-hmm.
increase it maybe to the level that it was during the great growth periods of the economy. It's now declined sharply. So that's one way to get revenue to overcome the deficit.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, protect the benefits. Protect Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Well, that's public opinion. Policy is about the opposite. In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats. So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy, and people don't feel that they can do very much.
Yeah, we've come to believe that and accept it. Well, you've written quite a bit. We only have a couple minutes left about the, well, it appears that the American empire is coming to an irrevocable end. I wonder, Professor Chomsky, how painful must that transition be to something else other than an empire, a republic, without foreign entanglements as envisioned by our founders? Can we do it, and can the 99% movement, the Occupy movement, play a part in this?
Well, there is a very definite decline in U.S. capacity to implement international policy goals, although the goals remain about the same, and they have for 60 years or more. Goals haven't changed much. They're formulated pretty much the same way. But the capacity to implement them is declining. On the other hand, the intention to implement them has not declined.
True.
So we still have, you know, whatever it is, 800 or so military bases around the world, the military expenses, which are almost as much as the rest of the world combined, vastly more advanced military technology, all of that continues. And so does intervention and so on when you can do it.
Right.
So, yes, the general story, I think, is the imperial system, or the system of global domination, is declining.
Yes.
in capacity to implement, but not very little in intention. And it's furthermore worth bearing in mind that this decline that everyone's talking about now is not new. In fact, the decline started in the late 1940s. If you go back to 1945, when the U.S. was absolutely at the peak of its power,
right.
In fact, at a peak that no other country had ever come close to.
For sure.
At that time, there were very definite and explicit plans about how to control most of the world. It was taken for granted that the U.S. would control the Western Hemisphere, the entire Far East, the former British Empire, and the commercial and industrial heartland of Eurasia, Western Europe. Well, you know, within a couple of years, that started to erode. In 1949, China declared independence. That's a big blow to the U.S. The global system, which had assumed that China would be part of it. In fact, it's interesting to see the phrase that's used for Chinese independence. It's called the loss of China.
Right.
And you can only lose something that you own.
Right.
Like I can't lose your car, let's say.
Right.
But it's just taken for granted we own it. And in fact, there's a big debate in the United States about who's responsible for the loss of China and so on and so forth.
Ridiculous.
Well, that already, back in the late 40s, is an indication of the gap that was growing between aspirations and capacity. And it's continued since.
Well, just quickly, because I know you have to run, and I have Senator George McGovern on the second half, but the 99% movement, the Occupy movement, might that help us in a transition away from an empire and to become more democratic and more Republican with a small r?
I certainly hope so. I think it's a very exciting movement. It faces very severe barriers, and if it can overcome them, which I think there's a chance that it can and certainly hope that it can, yeah, it could have exactly that effect. Kind of very important, I think, for us and for the world and also for the future. I mean, we can't forget the fact that we're mindlessly marching towards serious disaster. Now, for one thing, there's a constant threat of nuclear war. It never abates. But another is that we're marching towards environmental catastrophe.
Yeah, true.
And unless something is done about that, our children and grandchildren are going to be in deep trouble.
Professor Noam Chomsky, thank you very much for your time today, and we'll be following your important writings for the next few years, I'm sure, and keep it up. Thanks very much for being with us on the Burt Cohen
Show. Thank you very much. Good to talk to you.
All right, and of course you can Google Noam Chomsky and get more information there. After this short break, we'll be back with Senator George McGovern.
He blesses the boys as they stand in line. The smell of gun grease and their bayonets, they shine. He's there to help them all that he can. To make them feel wanted, he's a good holy man.
We've seen enough sky pilots, although Senator George McGovern was a sky pilot in the Second World War, less known for that than for many, many other things. Senator McGovern, thank you very much for being with us today on the Burt Cohen Show.
If you don't know, Senator George McGovern was the Democratic nominee for president in 1972 and served in the House and in the Senate for 18 years, and he holds the Distinguished Flying Cross for his service as a bomber pilot in the Second World War. And he, in the Senate, was an exemplar of modern American liberalism, and he became most known, of course, for his opposition to America's war in Vietnam. Throughout his career, Senator McGovern has been involved in issues related to agriculture, food, nutrition, and hunger. As the very first director of the Food for Peace program in 1961, Senator McGovern oversaw the distribution of U.S. surpluses to the needy abroad and was instrumental in the creation of the U.N.-based World Food Program. And under President Clinton, McGovern served as ambassador to the U.N. agencies for food and agriculture in Rome. Well, again, thank you very much for being with us today, Senator. In your most recent book, What It Means to Be a Democrat, you say, we are at a crossroads over how the federal government in Washington and state legislatures and city councils across the land allocate their financial resources. Which fork we will take will say a lot about Americans and our values. Well, my question is, how are we doing?
I think the United States is at a crossroads in terms of its politics. It has become so negative and so partisan. When I was a member of the United States Senate and the House of Representatives, a total of some 22 years, I never saw such narrow, negative, mean-spirited partisanship in the Congress of the United States. And one hears it night and day on the media. So I finally decided to write a book, not what I'm against, but what I think Democrats should be for. I'm not going to use this book to blast the Republican Party. They're doing that to themselves with these presidential contenders assailing each other week after week. And so this book is a positive book. What does the Democratic stand for? Or perhaps more specifically, what do I think the Democratic Party should stand for?
I wonder if, you know, what's going on with the...
It seems that the Democratic Party and candidates' connection to working people is not as solid as it was. And I wonder, did it start with the Reagan Democrats? Why is there this disconnect with working people, the people who traditionally been solidly with the Democrats? What can we do now to improve that situation? What's caused the disconnect and what can we do now?
Well, as you know, the labor unions are considerably weaker today than they were a quarter of a century ago. It used to be that we could pretty much depend, as Democrats, on a strong vote from organized labor. But now, the unions are considerably weaker than they were. I think one of the reasons for that is that these so-called social issues have come to play a major part in our politics. You know, issue like Rose, let's take the abortion issue. That issue shouldn't even be in politics.
Right.
That's not something for politicians in Washington to spend their time on in the Senate and in the House of Representatives. It's a very personal issue that is largely a female issue. You know,
sure.
You and I are never going to have an abortion.
Right.
No matter how hard we try, we're never going to have an abortion. It just doesn't happen to us males. So I just leave that issue to the women. I trust their judgment on it, and they can talk to their doctors about it. And I think that's an issue that we ought to leave in the hands of the women.
And it seems that the polling data shows that women are going with Democrats a heck of a lot more than Republicans these days. And you know as better than I that Democrats may be in great shape in a moment, but there's a long history of Democrats snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. We're in very good shape now, but I wonder if Democrats are offering clear enough alternatives. Are we making the most of the Democratic opportunity right now? Are Democrats being proactive enough? Or are we still just being reactive? Are we taking the opportunities we have?
Well, there's so much clearer on where they stand on public issues than our opponents. You know, it's hard to tell listening to these four or five people that are running for the Republican presidential nomination. On any given day, it's hard to describe what they're for. We know some of the things they're against because they talk about that over and over again. But I think the American people are more interested in what we stand for. What is the election of candidates A, B, and C going to mean in terms of improvements in our lives? And that's the thing that I try to do in this book, what it means to be a Democrat. I don't think there's much of a negative tone in that book, and I don't spend a lot of time talking about what's wrong with the Republican Party. 95% of that book is concentrated on what the Democratic Party is for. And I think it's the way it should be. You know, we need two strong, active political parties in the United States. A conservative party, which traditionally has been the Republican Party, and a liberal party, which traditionally has been the Democratic Party. Now, some of the things I hear coming out of these Republican presidential contenders tells me very little about what they're for. It tells me a lot about what they're against. Anything the Democrats are for, they seem to be against. They're even against Social Security and Medicare as they now stand. I think those are two of the most valuable and important programs on the statute books.
And we all remember in 1964 when a lot of people across the country kind of made fun of Barry Goldwater for being so right-wing. How do you think the people like Santorum today, Michelle Bachmann, people like that, compared to the Republican Party of Barry Goldwater?
Well, look, I would say this about Senator Goldwater and I were personal friends. Some people are surprised to hear that, but it's true.
Sure.
He always admired me because of my war record in the Second World War, flying a B-24 bomber on 35 missions against the most heavily defended targets in Europe. So he was always on a very congenial, personal basis with me. And I think that's the way it should be. I happen to be a close friend of Republican Senator Bob Dole. He and I have teamed up on the McGovern-Dole International School Lunch Program. And that's the way politics should be. We can't get much done if we don't have some bipartisan cooperation.
Senator, was it this partisan? I guess it wasn't this partisan during your tenure in the Senate. Or could it be that it's amplified, the partisan rancoring only amplified because of the 24-hour news cycle and the social media? Or has it really changed that much in terms of bipartisanship and civility?
Yes, it has changed. And I think you're quite right that that's also the tone of much of our media. You know, you listen to some of these talk show hosts that speak to millions and millions of Americans every week. These are guys that exploit fear. They exploit anxiety. They exploit frustration. And that's what keeps them in business, is the basic negative emotional feelings that are too strong across the country, partly because such negative or nervous feelings or fear feelings are aroused by media talk show kings.
Yeah, they definitely are. And fear, certainly one of the people that both you and I have admired the most, Franklin Roosevelt, understood the power of fear. And we've seen fear manipulated purposely by President George W. Bush and many others. I wonder if we're starting to get beyond that. Are Democrats countering fear with optimism? Certainly hope was the word used in the Obama campaign in 2008. I wonder where we're going with that. Are we getting over the fear? Are we seeing beyond that? Are we still being jerked around by the people who manipulate the fear?
You know, we had this one major terrorist attack on the United States. That was 9/11.
Of course.
2001. That's about 11 years ago. I think it's possible that we are overdoing our reaction to terrorism.
Yes.
You know, we've just had that one major attack. We could have another one, I suppose, just like we have 40 to 50,000 people killed in automobile accidents every year.
Right.
Now, when we invest so much of our time and energy and money in preparing against a possible repeat of the attack of 9/11, I think we are overdoing it. I go to the airport quite frequently. I'm still out traveling around the country. I do quite a bit of speaking. I'm now out promoting my book. But, you know, it's gotten to the point where I don't enjoy very much my visit to the airports anymore. You line up behind a big winding line of people who are preparing to take their shoes off and walk around either barefoot or in stocking feet because of one guy,
right,
apparently had either fowl or some other kind of white powder in his shoes. Now, that was many, many years ago, but we're still afraid of that guy. Look, every time you get in an automobile or an airplane, you're taking a risk. There's just a certain amount of accidents that are going to occur. But I think we've way overdone the fear that there might be a terrorist on board. I was talking to some of my friends the other day about that, and they said, well, George, at least you've got to admit we haven't had another attack since 9/11. I said, no. And we never had an attack before 9/11 of that dimension. So I'd like to be able to keep my shoes on when I prepare to go on an airplane. I hate going through these kind of search and destroy tactics that hit us at the airport. I'm more nervous about them and more fearful about them than I am the danger of another terrorist attack.
And, Senator, I loved a line in your new book. We live with too much fear and not enough common sense, so it seems. We can use some common sense. I wanted to move on. You know, one of the great things about Franklin Roosevelt was stimulating the economy, creating a lot of much-needed public works jobs. The people needed work. There was a lot of work to be done. It seems to me like we're in a similar situation now. And yet, a lot of Republicans argue we can no longer afford social investments. We have to reduce the deficit. Why is it that Democrats, you know, Obama did a little stimulus. It seems, I'm guessing you probably think it wasn't really enough. Why did Democrats shy away from public works jobs? It would so clearly stimulate demand and help the economy. What is it? Why do we shrink from that?
Well, I think the answer to that is that it takes some cooperation from the other party to get things done. They control the House of Representatives, so you can't get anything through Congress that doesn't have the endorsement of the House of Representatives. That's a Republican body. And I think that's the biggest problem that President Barack Obama has had. You know, it's interesting. Within a few days of the election of President Obama, the Republican leader in the Senate, this fellow from Kentucky, his name slips my mind right
Mitch
right
McConnell?
Now. Pardon?
Mitch McConnell?
Yeah, Mitch McConnell. He put out a public statement that he was going to use the next 4 years to defeat the Obama administration and all their work, that he would do everything he could to block this new president from getting anything through Congress. Well, that's not the way to be a patriot in the United States. You don't say you hope the president's going to fail and you're going to try to make sure he does. You know, in the 22 years I served in the House and Senate, I never once heard a leader of either party say they hoped the president of the United States would be a failure and that they were going to do everything they could to make sure he's a failure, that he doesn't get another term. I don't think that's patriotic. What has happened to pride in America? What has happened to cooperation on key problems between the two parties? We had that during all those years I was in the Congress. You know that I was very much opposed to sending young Americans over to that jungle in Vietnam.
Yes.
Now just about everybody knows that war was a dreadful mistake. But to try to stop it, I teamed up with a prominent Republican senator, Mark Hatfield, and we introduced in the Senate the McGovern-Hatfield Amendment to end the war. And we almost had enough votes to pass it through the Congress because we cooperated together instead of trying to defeat each other. And I think that's the kind of spirit we need now at a time when the country is in an economic crisis.
Should there be more of a stimulus? Do you think this is a good time for new public works jobs that could, you know, create jobs? And do you think that would be a good way to stimulate the economy? I understand there's massive resistance to that in the Congress, but do you think that would be a good thing for Democrats to be talking about as the election heads our way?
Yes, I do, absolutely. I'm not sure, and I don't know anybody else who is sure, that private industry can provide a job for everybody who wants to work. It may be that we've reached a situation where while they have great talent, great ability, that the private industry can't provide a job for every American that wants to work.
Clearly.
That was also the case in the 1930s during the Great Depression.
Right.
So what President Roosevelt did was to say, look, I'm not going to let 10, 15 million people sit around and do nothing. I'm going to put them to work in useful public employment that would help the country, building up the national parks, building up the national forest, building new bridges and courthouses and highways and water systems. All of those things need to be revitalized today, and they are public matters that demand public employment. So, yes, I think the Democrats should have pushed harder in that direction. But I also want to be realistic about this.
Right.
You know, Bert, that the Republicans would not have permitted that kind of a New Deal program to pass this time. They got control of the House of Representatives by a substantial margin, and they would rush to the barricades to block these programs that I've just mentioned are almost 100% strong. So it's a good idea. The Democrats should be pushing it, but it won't pass as long as the Republicans remain in control of the House of Representatives, a bill has to pass both houses to become law. And so this is the problem we're up against right now.
I would think with the election, you know, in full swing now, that it might be a good thing to talk about. And, you know, Democrats, I've been frustrated by what's been called the blue dog Democrats. It seems to me that showing leadership, standing up for something, you know, talking about public works jobs, and yes, one of your favorite subjects, railroads, it would help us just electorally, even, you know, recognizing that there's, you know, huge opposition in Congress. I think
I think that's right, and I wish the Democratic Party would come out foursquare for a series of work projects. You know, for the last 40 years, I thought that such a project might be building in America the fastest, the safest, the cleanest railway system in the world. And we get our money back several times over if we invested it in constructive projects of that kind. Let me just give you an illustration of how wisely invested public programs pay for themselves. Social Security. That's not a burden on the taxpayers of this country, because from the very beginning, it's been financed by withholding payments from the working people of America. The last I checked, they had a $2 trillion surplus in the Social Security trust fund. Let me say another case. I'm a beneficiary of the GI Bill of Rights that followed World War II. I came home from my bomber days in that war, and lo and behold, even though I had a wife and one child, the little girl being born while I was overseas in World War II, we had this wonderful GI Bill. You could go to any college in the country, from Harvard and UCLA and Stanford and Princeton, or you could go to Podunk Junior College, and the government would pay all your expenses, all your tuition, all your fees, all your books, plus a cost of living allowance. It cost a huge amount of money. But you want to know something? The government made big money on that program. Why? Because by educating 8 million GIs in World War II, they increased our educational standing, and they educated us in a way that we've been earning more money ever since. Still are. So that for every dollar the government shelled out to pay to educate 8 million GIs, they got back $2 in return. But I'm going to have to leave in a few minutes. We've been on about a half hour somewhere about near the end of this. Am I correct?
Yes. I wondered if I could just ask one more thing about food.
Oh, sure.
You've said compassion does more than make people feel good. It's a smart way to approach the world. You argue that food is more effective and cheaper in terms of foreign policy than trillions of dollars on weapons. Why isn't that?
Absolutely. You know, the first big splurge in our national debt came in the 1980s during the Reagan years. Why? Because he did two things in his 8 years in office. Every one of those 8 years, he sharply increased military spending. At the same time, he gave all the rich people a tax cut.
Yeah.
Well, you can't cut your revenues at the same time you're spending more money without having a big debt. And that's exactly what happened. $4 trillion added to the national debt.
Wow.
wow. in the 8 years of President Reagan. He was a congenial man,
yeah.
a popular actor. Everybody liked him. But the truth is that his fiscal policies were unsound. Now, it happened again under President Bush Jr.
Right.
He did the same thing. He cut taxes for the rich even more than Reagan had done. And then he got us into two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. And he added $5 trillion to the national debt. That's a total of $9 trillion added by Reagan and Bush, which is over half of the entire national debt. In contrast, President Bill Clinton reduced the national debt in his last 2 years in office and left a large surplus in the Treasury for his successor. So we need to get those facts out to the American people. We Democrats are not the kind of wild big spenders that the Republicans paint us to be. If you want some wild spending, look at the Reagan administration and the Bush Jr. administration. If you want some irresponsible tax policy, yeah. look at those two administrations for tax cuts that were given to people that least needed. These are hard facts that we ought to be talking about frequently.
And I do remember how often you've said about food, you know, if U.S. shows leadership in terms of food, medical help, agricultural supplies, that's a much more effective foreign policy. I know you have to go, Senator McGovern. It's been an honor. America would have been very blessed to have had you as president. It doesn't look likely that that's going to happen at this point. But thank you so much.
Bert, it's good to be on. I just want to say on the food situation, that has been the central passion of my life ever since World War II. I saw genuine hunger during that war. I saw children starving to death. I saw mothers gaunt and underfed and poorly fed. So I've been trying to reduce hunger in the world every way I possibly can ever since World War II. Now, we're making progress. In fact, we've made enormous progress on that effort, and we need to keep moving it.
We do, and that's a great way for America to show our leadership. The new book is What It Means to Be a Democrat, the author, Senator George McGovern. Thank you so much for being with us. Quite an honor. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Bert. It's been my pleasure.
All right. Thank you so much.